Welcome to River Hive Radio, a bi-monthly program broadening the bounds of discourse on progressive thought and progressive action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. Dubbed one of the most inspiring films of the year, Hollywood's latest rendition of prison life is the story of Reuben Carter, the 1960s boxing sensation who served almost 20 years in New Jersey state prisons for a triple murder he never committed. The film, called The Hurricane, has attracted widespread critical acclaim and raised questions in the minds of many Americans as to the true nature of our justice system. But to those more acquainted with the realities of America's courts, Hurricane Carter's story is far from unusual. Since 1976, 82 death sentences have been overturned or commuted, and several states are currently considering measures that would halt executions pending further investigation into charges of police corruption, racial bias, and inadequate public defense. Beneath all the hype is the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, a journalist and member of the Black Panther Party who was convicted of killing a Philadelphia police officer in 1981. Like Reuben Carter, Abu-Jamal's trial was fraught with injustice, including harassment and coercion of witnesses and concealment of evidence. Sadly, he remains on Pennsylvania's death row, despite widespread international effort demanding a new trial. In this edition of Bruderhof Radio, we'll hear from Abu-Jamal himself as he describes the plight of those trapped inside the justice system. Recently, Abu-Jamal has written about racial biases in the Pennsylvania court system, comparing the treatment of suspected mafia members with that of black revolutionary activists. The following two segments, recorded in January 2000, paint a stark picture of judicial prejudice.
We are all taught that all are equal in the eyes of the law, and for many people, that is their belief. What shatters that belief, however, is the reality of what actually happens in the courts of the land. Not what the courts say, but what they do. Let us examine two cases, the so-called mob in black and white. In 1992, the Pennsylvania Superior Court, in the case Commonwealth versus Scarfo et al., reversed the murder, conspiracy, and weapons charges of eight men who were alleged to be members of the mafia and granted new trials. The state's intermediate appellate court cited a number of reasons for that reversal, among them that the prosecution elicited testimony that the eight men were made mafia members. I quote from the opinion. The Commonwealth chose to focus on the activities of the mafia and not the activities of the conspiracy. The prosecution elected to employ a strategy whereby it could elicit defendants' prior criminal activities through the back door. The Commonwealth's nomenclature, made membership, totally circumvents the purpose of the rule against admission of evidence regarding prior crimes, end quote. The court also found that the eight men were prejudiced by the prosecutor's references to them in closing argument as wolves, a wolf pack, and similar animal imagery. Such terms serve to dehumanize the accused, said the court, and the Scarfo court wrote, justice in this case requires reversal for a new trial because the defendants were not treated with fundamental fairness. In 1995, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court decided Commonwealth versus Jones, a case involving a man said to be head of the JBM, or Junior Black Mafia. Throughout the trial, witnesses and prosecutors made repeated references to the JBM and attributed to them a number of separate offenses, including murder. On appeal, when Jones tried to argue that errors in his trial were similar to those made in Scarfo, the court thought otherwise. There, the court ruled, such repeated references to JBM weren't prejudicial, but factual, and testimony to other crimes were merely harmless. Two trials, two results. Two appeals, two results. Two different standards of what prejudice means. Two mobs, one white, another black. Two different kinds of justice. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Many are unfamiliar with the reality of death row, for the Corporationist Press paints a picture of the row as an abode of the worst of the worst, while a truer picture is of those who are poorest of the poor, or even the weakest of the weak. Philadelphia alone, dozens of people have been slain in the streets as local mafia wars raged for over a decade. Which leads to another question. How many mafia hitmen were in Pennsylvania's death row? The answer, zero. Not one. How can this be, you ask? And the answer is simple. Real mafia guys are able to afford the best lawyers that money can buy, while the poor schmuck is stuck with court-appointed lawyers, hardly the craft's best. So, guess who goes to death row? Death row, it seems, is the prerogative of the poor. And what about mafia hitmen? Truth be told, there was one once, and the DA's office in Philadelphia fought harder than most defense lawyers to get him off the row. Sure enough, quietly, they did so. In fact, he never lived under the deprivations that are familiar to all people on death row. Why? Because he testified against his alleged bosses. What emerges is the politics of death, that the well-to-do and well-connected can afford to escape, and where one's poverty is a definitive aggravating circumstance. I've written previously of the Fred Thomas case, of the diabetic grandfather whose witness in his defense was run out of court by cops later convicted in the infamous 39th District corruption scandal, of young Jimmy Dennis, whose alibi defense was tossed aside by the courts, innocent men whose real offense was not being able to afford adequate defense counsel. And I assure you, they are not alone. Death row is not just a poor place, but a predominantly black place, with most from Philadelphia. Again, we see the politics of death.
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
Of prosecutors and judges who seek political advancement on the basis of their fierce allegiance to the death penalty, except, it seems, when it comes to mafia hitmen. These same actors in the containment system have treated the Supreme Court's Batson case as little more than a joke. Batson allegedly outlaws using race as the basis for the removal of potential black jurors. But as a video training tape for the DA's office showed, the same game goes on by another name and with the same effect, predominantly white juries. Clearly, what the case claims and what the courts of the Commonwealth actually do are two very different things. And the result is predictable. Death. Clearly, unquestionably, this is time for a change. I thank you. On a move, long live John Africa. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Until recently, the change Abu-Jamal refers to seemed very far away indeed. Last year, 98 people were executed in the United States, the most in 1 year since reinstatement of the death penalty in 1976. In several states and at the federal level, steps have been taken to speed up the execution process and limit appeals for men with a date to die. Here, in a piece recorded on January 9th, Abu-Jamal addresses a group of German activists about yet another negative trend he sees in America, the execution of juveniles.
In the month of January 2000, several young men who were juveniles at the time of their offenses will be put to death by Texas and Florida. What kind of nation kills its own kids? America is that kind of nation. It matters not what any international convention or treaty may say. Those boys will be dead before the month changes into February. Why should any of this matter to you who live in other countries other than the U.S.? What has this to do with you? Well, as a recent battle in Seattle has shown, the forces that are straining to restrict, repress, and commodify human and other lives is a global one, one which moves in darkness and in secret. Now, if repression is global, why not, too, is it resistance? If the interest of capital to make global profits is an important one, why not the simple human right to life? As the ways of business dictate the broader rules under which all life is to be lived on this planet, why not the ways of resistance? Why is it not life that takes precedence over profit? People abroad are well placed to call the U.S. on the deep death culture that obtains here. Criticism from within the country, if at all, is muted. For America is a nation obsessed with legalism. Devoid of any national tradition of kings, all that is deemed legitimate comes from written law. Why do you think the U.S. took almost a half century to sign the anti-racism and anti-genocide conventions? In a move that guts the spirit while embracing the letter, Congress passes such accords with what they term reservations. That's conditions that transform such pacts into meaningless scraps of paper that no judge, no court, no institution need respect. As this is an election year in America, there's a rush to death, for nothing improves a politician's position as much as an execution, whether there was such a mobilization on behalf of life. Your actions, therefore, on behalf of life, become vitally important to reflect back the unflattering picture of the American culture of death, where over 3,500 men and women await death at the hands of the state, where among that number, some 80 youth, 17 years old and younger, await the gallows. From you may come that which does not yet exist in the U.S., an ethic of life.
Despite his candid analysis of the American death culture, Abu-Jamal is quick to acknowledge signs of hope. He sees the recent death penalty moratorium declared by Illinois Governor George Ryan as evidence of a shift in public opinion and hopes other states will follow suit. For this to happen, he says, many more stories of innocence and wrongful conviction must come to the surface. One such story is that of Abu-Jamal's fellow inmate, Fred Thomas.
Banished to the most exclusive club in America are deemed worthy of damnation, and in truth, all are presumed guilty, for did not a jury say so? Then one meets Fred Thomas, 53-year-old great-grandfather, who was projected to a jury as homeless, heartless, and in the words of the DA, quote, a predator, unquote. In a brief, week-long trial that went poorly defended, a jury convicted Fred of first-degree murder, and a day later, on February 28, 1995, sent Fred to death row in Pennsylvania. Now, why should one care about a homeless, heartless predator? Clearly, the jury didn't. What the jury never learned was that an eyewitness, located the day after the killing of a FedEx driver in the so-called Badlands of North Philly, gave a statement to the cops that she witnessed the shooting, named two of the assailants, and described the third, none of which remotely resembled Thomas. Indeed, her statement was corroborated by another witness who saw the three men running away. I know. The question arises, well, how did the prosecutor convict this man? Well, in their first attempt, they didn't, for the jury refused to convict and a hung jury was declared. In the second trial, the state provided two witnesses, both crack addicts, who claimed they saw Fred fleeing the scene, but even they couldn't go as far as saying they saw him shoot anyone, or even armed. According to the woman who did see the shooting, however, one of the assailants was related to one of the two witnesses who now placed Fred at the crime scene. These witnesses, both of whom had extensive criminal histories, were not asked about their drug-related activities despite repeated requests of counsel to do so. A homeless man, desperate for a dollar to survive, might rob and kill a truck driver, as would a drug addict. But Fred wasn't a homeless man nor an addict, but a hard-working man who worked a variety of jobs to support his growing family. He's innocent of murder, and as this was written, did have a date to die for November 23rd, 1999. He did receive, since this writing, a stay of execution. Now, in truth, this is his second death warrant, but the question arises, will he survive death row? A 53-year-old who recently was diagnosed as diabetic is now insulin dependent. He has one fervent hope. He says, I hope my health don't give out so I can live long enough to prove my innocence. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Mumia Abu-Jamal on Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly radio program focusing on progressive thought and activism. We'd like to hear from you if you have questions or comments about today's program. You can call us at 1-800-778-8461 or visit us on the internet at www.freespeech.org/Bruderhof. In addition to wrongful conviction like that suffered by Fred Thomas, many inmates face a lengthy appeals process equally doomed to failure. Shaka Sankofa has lived on Texas death row since 1981. The National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty has highlighted his case for its injustice, saying, quote, compelling evidence exists which points to his innocence. Abu Jamal's recounting of this story reveals the horror of waiting for death not once, but many times.
On September 5, 1999, the man born as Gary Graham marked his 36th year in life and his 18th year in a Texas cage. Several years ago, the black death row prisoner changed his name to Shaka Sankofa after the great founder of the Zulu Empire of Southern Africa. For years, he's been fighting for his life, most recently against one of the most brutal killing states in America. Texas leads the nation in executions, spurred at least in part by the presidential aspirations of its governor, George W. Bush. Supporters from as diverse